Hello, and welcome to the first episode for March 2024 of the very best podcast about rural happenings in Dorset. I'm Jenny Devitt.
And hello from me, Terry Bennett.
And in this episode, we'll have your letters to the BV.
Simon Hoare, MP, writes on the subject of buying British food, being sensible when walking dogs near livestock, the recent rejection of a planning application for a ghettoised refugee park near Blandford, and the much-vaunted concept of joined-up government.
Ken Huggins of the North Dorset Green Party calls for us to protest, and again protest against the government's actions. Gary Jackson of the North Dorset Liberal Democrats gives a plea that the government should act with more prudence. Please do no more harm, he urges. And Labour's Pat Osborne calls Dorset Council's second home tax a pointless cash cow policy. And we'll hear about Lucy Nolan's specialist gun dog training business near Buckland Newton. First, as always, we start this first March episode by hearing from our editor, Laura.
Time is peculiar. I think I can say with confidence that January was at least 10 weeks long, but February was about 11 days maximum by my very scientific reckoning. This month, I interviewed a number of local business owners, entirely different businesses at entirely different stages, from a one-year startup to a 30-year established firm. But each of those business owners had done exactly what Courtney and I have done, and so many others with us. At one point, we just took a deep breath, gritted our teeth, and went for it. Running your own business isn't for everybody. Frankly, many people get a glazed look of horror when you start talking about the realities of it. But when I asked each of those entrepreneurs what they loved about running their own business, the answer was always the same. And it's the same that I would give, and I suspect it's the same thing that every small business owner in the country will say. It's the independence, the freedom. You have never worked so hard, but you've never minded less. The benefits of being your own boss far outweigh the downsides. It's no wonder that one in three adults in the UK dreams of quitting their job and setting up on their own. Whether it's a secret baker who yearns for a sticky bum business or a surveyor tired of having their day micromanaged. It doesn't matter what you do, some people just decide they want to give it a go. It takes courage to start, and it takes grit and determination to make it succeed. If you know someone who runs their own business, never underestimate just how important it is to them or how fast they're learning. Also, try and support them. It's pretty easy and it's free, actually. You just follow them on social media, like and share their posts. It genuinely helps. Tell your friends and family about them. Tell them yourself just how good they are. That matters more than anything. The BV team work incredibly hard to support and raise up local small businesses. A quick flick through this issue, I've just counted 25 of them. Not paid adverts, just us writing about local people doing good things. Let's all do more than just applaud from the sideline. We should stop and try that brand new cafe, browse our friend's shop, pass on a good word about them. Small gestures that really matter. And if you're one of the one in three dreaming of taking the plunge, may I point you to page 32 in the magazine? There's some priceless advice in those pages from people who've learned their lessons the hard way. Have a lovely month. I'll see you in April. That's about 61 days, yes?
Politics. Farming, community and no to a ghetto, Simon Hoare, MP for North Dorset, writes as follows. For this month's column, I thought I would look at some varied topics rather than a thematic piece. Farming and food production remains one of the largest parts of the UK's economy. It outstrips the automotive and aeronautical industries by some distance. North Dorset-born Dr. Luke Evans, MP for Bosworth, launched a campaign in 2023 to persuade supermarkets to have a Buy British section on their websites. It started small, with just a few of us supporting him, but it grew and took root, with a raft of my parliamentary colleagues adding their voice. Morrison's, Sainsbury's and Aldi have all now created Buy British tabs on their websites, and we have to hope that other retailers will follow suit. I would encourage readers to write to the chief executives of businesses urging them to do so. Such action would augment and support the recent announcements made by the Prime Minister at the NFU conference, strongly supporting farming. Still on the subject of farming, we are on the cusp of the lambing season. We dog owners need to remember that our adored companions are not that far removed from the wolf, and that latent instincts can kick in. Please, please, please ensure your dog is on a lead when around livestock. I've seen for myself the mauled carcasses and also the mutilated yet still barely alive ewes and lambs that have been attacked by dogs. It's not pretty. One cannot claim to be an animal lover and then act, or rather not act, in a way that leads to devastating, painful and costly attacks. Please be sensible and cautious. On the subject of being sensible, I was delighted that the Planning Inspectorate refused the appeal to create a ghettoised caravan park for Ukrainian refugees on open land near Blandford. We've all welcomed Ukrainians fleeing the war as they seek sanctuary from the horror, and we've housed them with families to provide stability, support and comfort. We've not stuck them in a caravan in some isolated field. Residents, Blandford Town Council, I and others recognised this proposal for what it was, a not particularly well-disguised Trojan horse to support a future application for housing development on a site which has already been explored and rejected for new homes. The inspectorate listened to our policy-based concerns and dismissed the appeal. It was the wrong scheme on the wrong site, promoted for entirely the wrong reasons. Many of us will be familiar with the phrase joined-up government. Sometimes it feels more like an aspiration than an actual way of working. Against this backdrop, I thought readers might be interested to hear briefly about my joint work as part of the DHLUC ministerial team with my opposite numbers. We are all concerned about bed blocking, people in hospital who are ready to leave, but due to delays in their at-home care packages, find themselves stuck in hospital. The Department of Health and Social Care and I are working closely to ensure maximum integration between our councils, who provide the care, and the NHS. Likewise, I am working very closely with ministers in the Department for Education on issues relating to SEND policy, home-to-school transport, and policies towards combating child abuse and exploitation. The role of local government, for which I have ministerial responsibility, is absolutely pivotal, given its place in service provision. There's more to do, I know, but steady delivery of joined-up government on policies that really matter to the lives of so many in North Dorset is a good place to begin. One of the most satisfying parts of an MP's role is the advice surgery. Constituents who have been wrestling with a problem for months come and see me to explain the issues and seek my help. No MP is a miracle worker, but the magical properties that the words Member of Parliament have still amazes me. With those three words, attention is gained and action summed up. We can't solve all of the problems, but we do give everyone a damn good try. If you think I can help, please email me at simon.hoare.mp@parliament.uk to arrange an appointment.
And Ken Huggins of the North Dorset Green Party has this to say.
Along with the looming spectre of unstoppable climate change, the urgent need to resolve the crisis in Gaza stands out at the moment. The horror of Hamas's barbaric attack in Israel on 7th of October last year has been followed by the horrors of Israel's response, which has continued for months now. While our parliament ties itself in knots, simply trying to agree how to word the call for an end to it all, innocent Palestinians are being slaughtered in their thousands, many of them women and children. The UK is complicit while ever it continues to supply Israel with military equipment. You can't claim the moral high ground and condemn the authoritarian behaviour of other countries' rulers whilst happily making money doing business with them. And I applaud the continuing public protests of Israelis against the actions of their hard-right government. The right to challenge a government's actions is one of our most precious, fundamental democratic rights, but our present UK government is actively seeking to suppress public protests, especially those of environmental groups. The last thing it wants is for attention to be drawn to its disastrous environmental record, and it wants protests to only be allowed when they are done in such a way that they can be easily ignored. Scientists began warning decades ago of the dire consequences of global warming caused by the burning of fossil fuels. Since 1995, annual international conferences have generated a lot of hot air, but completely failed to stop the steady increase in greenhouse gas emissions. increasingly desperate protests by concerned citizens have mostly drawn hostility from right-wing media, with the Daily Mail, for example, branding protesters eco-zealots and recommending French police tactics of tear gas and baton charges. The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act 2022 and the Public Order Act 2023 are both designed to have a chilling effect on public protests, along with the government urging judges to prevent protesters telling juries why they are protesting. Now there are proposed amendments to the Criminal Justice Bill. We're on a slippery slope and we lose our right to effective protest at our peril.
Now let's hear from Gary Jackson of the North Dorset Lib Dems.
Whether you were an early and avid reader of this fine magazine, or just let the politics section languish, you'll now be chewing over the Chancellor's budget decisions and statement back on 6th of March. Whenever you listen to this, the clock is ticking down on the current government, which explains a great deal about the approach the Chancellor took in his budget. First, let's recall that it's only been a few short months since the Prime Minister promised long-term thinking and that he was the change we desperately need. Now, apparently, it's about short-term thinking to prevent the change that we need. I saw some of the papers before the budget statement warning us of Jeremy Hunt's tax sandwich. This is where some thin but hopefully sufficiently distracting tax cut filling would be briefly inserted between two doorstep wedges of highly taxed bread. One slice is already in operation, and the other will be applied on the other side of the election, not by a new Labour government, but by current Conservative plans already set out to 2027-28. So as the clock ticks down on the slapstick and dramas of the current government, surely they owe the country a more dignified and competent final act. For a while, there were glimpses of grown-up decision-making with worthy tax breaks for business investment. But taxes remain at their highest level on record. This is due to a continued freeze on tax thresholds while public services are starved. The budget should be the opportunity for redemption. Instead, it all was depressingly political tax cuts, shamefully aimed at political survival. These choices risk making the nation's long-term challenges even harder to fix, like applying a band-aid to a wound that already needs stitches. So what choices would I make? The focus would be on what I see we need in North Dorset and across the UK. Prudent spending and investment in public services, infrastructure, health and defence. Giving people back their money is right when other factors are under control, but people are worried about critical shared public services. Cutting taxes now was ill-advised. The Chancellor should have acted more like a doctor and done no more harm. Conservative populists, who steered the country towards so many cliff edges, owe the nation a period of quiet governance on their way out. They must resist the political game-playing and fantasy fiscal football.
Letters to the editor. And Laura prefaces this section with the following. Our postbag was busy after last month's story on the Blackmore and Sparkford Vale Hunt suspension, and I've selected a couple of representative views. None of those contacted was willing to have their name and address published in connection with this matter.
It was terrific to see you cover the B&SV Hunt story properly. Whichever side of the Hunt debate you lie on, there can be no ambiguity on the law around allowing a pack of dogs to kill a fox in front of you. The B&SV Hunt have not done themselves, nor other responsible hunts, of which there are some, contrary to popular opinion, any favours by allowing such practices to continue. At a time when we are expecting a new Labour government, who are already planning tougher measures on hunting, due specifically to this kind of action, it is more important than ever that hunts abide by the spirit of the law, even if they say there are loopholes in the meaning of the words. Well done to the BV and to Andrew Livingston for the factual, calm and unsensational reporting.
How long will these hunts continue to get away with their incessant and blatant disregard of the law, says our next correspondent. The drone footage was shocking. Well done to the SABs for obtaining such irrefutable evidence. As a lifelong Dorset resident, I am only too aware that in the past, the SABs have been as much of a problem as the Hunt themselves. I hope this is changing, and calm, clever data recording is the way forward for a suitable solution on all levels.
I have long since noted that it says a lot about a news publication when a difficult story happens right on their patch. Do they ignore it, sensationalise it, or investigate it thoroughly? Well done, BV team, on tackling the Hunt story head-on, and in such a detailed, balanced manner.
Andrew Livingston of Hook writes on the subject of rugby. It's not often your favourite local news publication reports on your favourite sport. When I saw the picture of Jerome Kano in last month's BV, I was jumping for joy, until I read the byline. For someone who describes himself as a fan of the sport from such a young age, I was extremely disappointed with Sam Peters' article and how little time he spent talking through the benefits of playing rugby, especially at a young age. I played at school and for my local club of Bridport RFC from the age of 4. I never witnessed anyone suffer from a concussion. I don't doubt that there's an issue with concussions in the professional game, but these figures don't compare with either the junior or amateur levels. In his article, Mr. Peters says that he hopes to see the game return to being an evasion sport. Since its conception, rugby has been an invasion game, the object being to get the ball over the opponent's try line. If the game were to become an evasion game, as Mr. Peters so hopes, then you take away the fundamental part of why the sport is so welcoming for such a huge demographic of young children. It's a sport for all shapes and sizes. Evasion excludes players that are of a larger size from taking part. They don't have the agility to avoid and move around defenders. I don't know where my life would be if I hadn't picked up a rugby ball as a chubby child. I know for a fact that I wouldn't have the skills I do in leadership and teamwork, nor the respect for those in authority. I respect that Mr. Peters is a distinguished journalist, but it's been a long time since he played rugby as a child. Did he really learn what's best for children from watching a professional sport that bears little resemblance to the one that gets kids out, being active and happy? I would love to see him use his platform to also highlight what's great about rugby, not just bash the professional level of the sport that gives so many of us 80 minutes of happiness a week.
This year's Child Oakford pantomime was a tale that loosely follows the Sleeping Beauty story, wonderfully penned by John Nash. There were three shows, Friday and Saturday night, plus a delightfully chaotic matinee on Saturday afternoon, and all three were performed to full houses. The cast were clearly inspired by the fabulous steampunk set painted by Rob Adams and Celia Ebden, which was echoed by the costumes created by Jackie Chapman and Gilly Gale. Throw in dramatic lighting by Mike Powell and, sometimes hilarious, sound effects from Tim Bainan, and this panto was ready to be baked. The cherry on top was the superb musical interpretation of Phil Blake and Nick Briggs, despite losing their drummer 24 hours before curtain up. There were fairies on scooters and an evil sorceress with the obligatory frog-eating, simpering sidekick, singing Paint It Black, the best bad jokes and classic panto moments all stitched together under the imaginative direction of Sammy Upton. Happy audiences headed home, still grinning, saying that that was the best one yet and wish there were still tickets for tomorrow. Speaking to some of the cast after the last show, they wanted to express their thanks to the audiences for their energy and inspiration. I, for one, can't wait for the next production. And that letter came from Barbara Ireland of Child Oakford.
Gay Piri Weir of Wincanton asks, can you help? When we first arrived in North Dorset, there was a bakery called Smith's in Gillingham, on Harding's Lane, I think, and they used to make a particular loaf called a special. I'm wondering if anyone in the area has the recipe. We've tried time and time again to replicate it without success. Can anyone help? And if you can, please contact letters@bvmagazine.co.uk.
Jeremy Bloomfield wrote in on eStar. I'm disappointed and indeed surprised that the BV have not informed their readers that Dorset Council, in their wisdom, have refused to install traffic lights on the eStar A30 crossroads. The grandly titled Collision Reduction Officer states that this site is too constrained, whatever that means, and any signalling would be difficult to achieve, and that the scheme was likely to be so expensive that it would not be justifiable. He goes on to say that there are no capacity issues at the junction, so it has not even been costed before a decision made. Now we'll have to wait for a fatality before the council take the required decision. Hedge cutting and road markings are not enough. They only regard any collisions that have taken place as slight. Disgraceful.
Mike Chapman writes on yet more development. Boughton, the most northerly part of Dorset, continues to try and absorb the 30-plus families on the housing development of the former Boughton Mill site. The GP surgery in the next village is small and already extremely busy. St George's Primary School is turning away the kids of new arrivals. Yes, admittedly, we have a garage and a small convenience store, a drafty barn for a village hall, a pub and a church. There are almost no other places of employment. The village's primary asset, however, is its setting, astride the nascent Stour, nestled under the scarp slope of the Cranbourne and West Wiltshire Downs national landscape, with heritage buildings and important views, green fields in every direction. Remote rural village, right? So here's the plan. Let's increase the number of houses from about 400 to more than 500 in short order, adding a couple of hundred more cars which will be driven to work, school, leisure, shops, healthcare, dentist. Let's inject not one but two new densely packed housing estates on greenfield sites outside the long-standing settlement boundary, plus some other infill projects. Why would you do that? Why would you wreck an ancient settlement and destroy community well-being for a generation? Why would you add all that carbon? To make money, of course. How sad. How greedy. How unnecessary.
And finally, a call from Sherborne Abbey. Sherborne Abbey is seeking descendants of those commemorated on monuments and memorials. The Abbey is developing a project to provide toilets and a new vestry in its historic church building. This will involve adjustments to a number of monuments and memorials, some of them lost in the mists of time, but some more recent. We'd be pleased to hear from anyone who may have an interest, particularly descendants of those commemorated, including Abbot Clement, circa 1155, Sir Thomas Wyatt, 1542, Sir John Horsey, circa 1560, George Brown, 1709, Elizabeth, wife of James Piddle, 1710, Pemberton Methuen, 1835, and Richard and Francis Hodgson, 1918. If you'd like to know more, please write to the parish office at 3 Abbey Close, Sherborne DT93LQ, and the email address is joanna.sams@sherborneabbey.com. And for general information on the project, visit sherborneabbey.com/new-facilities. In last month's podcast, we heard from regular BV astrophotographer Rob Nolan about his beautiful photos of some of the wonders of our galaxy. Today we'll hear about the very much more down-to-earth work of his wife Lucy. She has two part-time jobs, one of which is specialist gun dog training. She's been a devoted fan of gun dog breeds, in particular spaniels, since she was young. So what could be more natural than to turn that love of gun dogs into a career, even if at present it's a part-time career?
I did my training and I, you know, started it as a, well, let's just see. I was still working full-time, but I was like, oh, let's just see how it goes. And, you know, didn't expect it to be grow. I guess I just didn't really, but not that I didn't believe in myself, but it's one of those things. I think you just try it and see how we go, and then it's just got busier and busier. So from up until Christmas, I was working 7 days a week practically.
So has that surprised you, the fact that it's taken off?
Yeah, I mean, I know other people that have got dog training business, you know, gone dog training business and things like that, and everyone said, you know, it's busy, that, you know, the dog industry generally is busy. But yeah, I mean, I am surprised, but it's always good, isn't it, really, to be busy and lots of new clients. joining and, you know, clients coming back. And yeah, no, it's definitely, yeah, I think it's just one of those things. I started and I was just, I think I had a very much open mind of let's just see where it goes and how I get on, really.
So the time might be not very far distant when you can do it full time, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, possibly. Who knows? I mean, I was just talking to my husband this morning when we were out on our dog walk, and I was just saying I'm sort of booking people way, way in advance now. A lot of my regulars are booking sessions, you know, quite, you know, up until sort of June time, you know, so they want to get their sessions in and they want to, you know, they're committed to training. So, yeah, it's nice to know that I've got, you know, a really good regular client base now that are also coming back. But there's still a lot of new people joining as well. So, yeah, hopefully, who knows? I kind of just tend to go with it, really, and keep an open mind.
Lucy, does your net stretch quite widely?
Is in the area that I cover, or
yes, how big an area are you attracting people from?
It's sort of primarily sort of Dorset, really. That's sort of my patch. But you know, I've got clients that are you know, down towards, I'm sort of mid Dorset sort of way, so in between Dorchester and Sherborne is where I'm based. But I've got clients that are over from Gore and Bournemouth, and then up towards Shaftesbury, over to Yeovil and Ilminster and things like that. So it's that sort of, I think there's people, you know, I think people are prepared to drive about up to an hour, I think, you know, for training. So that's sort of roughly where I sort of my reach goes, I think. I do get inquiries from other areas, but then when they realise I'm too far out of their, you know, out of their area. But no, it's quite a generically Dorset is what I cover.
But it says something for the quality of the training you offer, doesn't it? That people are prepared to drive an hour to get to you, then have the training, then an hour to get back home.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also it's just, but also a commitment for them as well. You know, it's a commitment for them, and for me, it just shows how committed they are to their dog as well for training. You know, for wanting to invest that time as well.
Very satisfying for you.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And is it primarily training pet gun dogs?
It's a mix, really, my clients. So I've got those that are pets and don't have plans to work them, but they still want to train them in the way that they were bred for. And there's also those that are then working in the field or planning to work in the field. Some have had, you know, dogs, you know, gun dogs before that they've worked in the field, and they've got a younger dog. Or I've recently had a few clients that have adopted an older dog. Perhaps that dog hasn't worked out in the home that it was in. So it's then come to my client, and then they plan to then train the dog and then work the dog in the field. So it's a mix, really.
So, Lucy, which breeds are actually classified as gun dogs?
It's a mix, really. So you've got, there's sort of different groups. So you've got your retrievers. So for instance, like your Labradors, your Golden Retrievers. And those are bred to retrieve shot game. And then you've got your Spaniels, which were, you know, bred primarily to flush game, so to flush it over the guns to then be shot. But, you know, there's a lot of Spaniels that also do retrieving as well. You've then got your pointers and setters, and then you've also got your HPR group as well. So those are the hunt point retrievers. So those in there are pointers, you've got Vizslas as well, and there's the pointers are, you know, you've got the German wirehead pointer, the German shorthead pointer, you've got the Hungarian Vizsla, and you've also got the English pointer as well. So there's quite a wide variety. And then also I am training a different breeds as well. So there's miniature wirehead Dachshunds that I'm training, and I've also recently had an Irish Water Spaniel as well, who I'm also training. So it's quite a mix.
Well, they all sound, Lucy, to me, with the exception of the Daxies. These all sound like breeds that love nothing so much as a nice muddy patch of a pond or to roll in.
you'll be surprised, actually, because of all the rain we've had recently, the fields are really muddy. So, but a lot of the dogs aren't so keen, you know, on being out in the mud. I've got one he's 7 months old, German wirehair pointer, and he refused to go through the puddle. There's quite a big puddle that into the gate into the field, so his owner had to pick him up and carry him across. So So not always in for the mud and the wet weather.
But of course, that water spaniel, Irish water spaniel you mentioned a moment ago, I have friends who've always had them, and they love nothing so much as patch of water, puddle, in it.
Definitely. It didn't seem to bother him yesterday at all with all the mud and everything. No, he was quite happy.
Lucy, you call your business Adhara Dog Training. Now, what does the Adhara mean? And have I pronounced that correctly?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I say Adhara, but Adhara, I think that's sort of the right way. So my husband, Rob, does a monthly article for the BV. So he does astrophotography.
I know. So, we talked to him for last month's podcast.
Oh, yes,
podcast.
Of course. That's what you spoke to him. Yes, yeah, of course you did, Jenny. Rob's got a real passion for astrophotography and the night sky. And I do as well. We live in an area where we've got very limited light pollution. We have amazing stars, which obviously attributes to what Rob can produce. So my interest isn't as much as Rob's, but I do appreciate it and do love it. And the constellation of the dog, which is Canis Major, one of the stars in there, I think it's the second brightest, is called Adhara. So when I was looking for a business name, it was quite hard, really, because you look round and somebody's already got this name and somebody's got that name, and I wanted something a little bit different as well. So we thought Constellation of the Dog, it's to do with dogs, our interest in the night sky, Adhara. So, yeah, that's where it came from.
And I'm sure that lots of your customers ask you, what does this name mean?
Yeah, some do, actually, and some don't, actually. And with the article in the BV recently, I explained it there. And, some of my clients said, I understand now where the name comes from.
Now, Lucy, what's the ethos of the training you offer? Training with kindness, being calm all the time?
It's, it's very much about trying to get the best out of your dog. It's sort of motivational training, effective training. But it's also, that some of the breeds that we work with are very strong. They're very strong-willed. So it's trying to educate the owners on the best way to deal with their dog, and to try and get the best out of them. So you as your dog's owner have got to be the main motivator for your dog. But, I'm also very much, what else motivates your dog? Is it food? Is it play? Is it a case of just verbal praise, or maybe a little scratch on the head, or a scratch on the chest? Every dog's different, and that's what's really important for me and for the owners to really work out, like, what really motivates your dog in order to try and get the best out of them.
And Lucy, I guess as many dog owners will admit, training a dog successfully really involves training the owner, doesn't it?
Yes, that's what my job is, really, as a sort of an instructor as such. I guess that's what we say is to train the owner, and then so they have got the ability to then go off and train their dog.
It's really all about, I guess, isn't it, understanding how a dog's mind works and the language it speaks.
It is, but it's also important that understanding the owners, and everybody learns differently as well. So that, for me, is a key, in terms of how you communicate. There's lots of different learning styles for humans, and it's important for me to understand that with my clients, so I can then explain or show them or whatever way to help them learn. So then, yes, then they can go away and work with their dog as well, because, again, dogs are the same. They learn differently. Some learn faster than others. Some it takes a bit more time. Some are a bit more stimulated by their environment, so you have to work a bit harder with their engagement. But what I say to owners is, train the dog you've got in front of you. Don't compare your dog to others. It's really hard, especially when we do group training. Some dogs progress quicker than others, and some of that is to do with age as well. I have a mix of ages in my group training. But it really is just, don't compare your dog to anyone else, and really just focus and train the dog that you've got in front of you. That's very important for owners to understand.
So just like people, every dog is an individual.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And so, Lucy, when a new client and dog arrive, I guess you have to assess them both very quickly, don't you?
Yeah, not so quickly. I mean, I always say for my one-to-one training that my first, the first session, I call it an assessment, just to find out talk to the owners what they're wanting to get out of the training. Some of them have very specific goals, such as just wanting their dog to walk nicely on a lead, you know, recall when the dog comes back, so the dog comes back when it's called. Some want to actually just progress more into the gun dog training as a pet, but it's trying to work out what their goals are and then see where the dog's at, see where the owner's at, and then go from there. And the important thing for me also is the relationship between handler and dog. You know, that is, you know, if you don't have a relationship with your dog, it's very difficult to train them. So sometimes I do see dogs that are don't necessarily have the best relationship with the handler, and that's why I say you need to go away, you know, work on that, work on your engagement as well as the training.
Now, you've always grown up with dogs, particularly gun dogs, haven't you, Lucy?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you, when you meet a dog for the first time, do you find that you have an instant rapport with it?
Not necessarily. Some dogs are very nervous and very stuck to their owners. Sometimes I will, you know, sort of ask the handler, can I use your dog? And then I'll sort of show them what I can do to demonstrate, because I'd appreciate a lot of people are visual learners as well. So they learn by watching. But some dogs are very nervous as well. So I can't always do that. So it's just very much working out what the dog is as well and how they are. Some are more confident than others, and it's just working with that.
Have you come across, you've not been doing this for very many years yet, have you yet come across a dog that you felt was a kind of rather beyond training?
Not beyond training, no, but I think there are some that perhaps should really be in more working homes than pet homes, I think, really. It's difficult sometimes, I think, when you've got a very, very driven dog. They don't cope well in just necessarily being in a pet home and being walked once a day. So that's where my training comes in, and that's what I try and educate, you know, the owners to do. But sometimes they don't necessarily understand that. But we just try and do what we can and get the best out of them as we can.
Now, Lucy, you're the only accredited gun dog trainer in Dorset, aren't you? And you have a proper accreditation. You went through quite a lengthy training, didn't you?
Yeah, it was important for me because as I started training my own dogs, you know, my friends said, "Oh, can you help me?" And I started doing that and helping a few people, and you know, I enjoyed it. And I thought, well, actually, if I want to do this, then I need to, you know, perhaps look at some qualifications and see what I can get. And it's quite scary actually, because the dog training world is unregulated. You know, there's no governing body, there's nothing. So you, Jenny, could do a few hours course or a 1 week course.
Heaven forbid.
But then go and call yourself a dog trainer, you know, and get yourself set up. So it's quite scary. So for me, it's very important. I'm that type of person that I want to be the best that I can be in what I do. And I've been following Les Graham and the Pet Gun Dog for quite some time. I've read the books. And so she offers the accredited Pet Gun Dog Instructors Programme, which, yes, is 18 months long. There's monthly assignments, which also include monthly tasks that I have to do with my dog and training sessions, and send that all to Les for sort of marking and assessing. And then there were workshops in Scotland, and it was very, very involved, but it's all set up to produce the best possible instructors that there can be.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, Lucy, that COVID took away so many opportunities for so many people, but it gave some the opportunity to do what they really wanted, which was your case, as I understand it.
Yeah, it was. It was just, you know, just sort of during lockdown, I think everyone had that moment, didn't they, really? Just, you know, you're sat at home. I mean, I was still working during lockdown, but I was working from home, and I'd had Bella and, you know, enjoyed working her. And then she had a litter of puppies as well, which we then kept Penny. And it just, you know, I just loved working my dogs and training my dogs, and I have a real passion for it. And also the benefit of the training, you know, how much it's benefited Bella and our relationship. And it's just from there a passion was just born. And I thought, well, no, I saw the training opportunity and I thought, well, let's give it a go and see how I go.
And finally, Lucy, do you think that the people who come to you with their dog for training have a better appreciation of that dog after you've trained them both?
I think it's trying to find a balance. You know, I talk about relationship, really. It's trying to find sort of a balance in that relationship between the owner and the dog. Training a dog takes time. It takes consistency and it takes patience. So it's trying to get the owners to sort of understand that, really, and put in that time and that commitment as well.
And also to understand that the dog is not another human being.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it's sort of explaining and trying to get them to, you know, a way that they can effectively communicate together.
And that's it for this first episode of the March 2024 BV podcast. Terry and I will be back in a week or two with the second episode. Until then, it's bye-bye from me, Jenny Devitt.
And it's goodbye from me, Terry Bennett.